Hello, friends. Here we are on the 14th of July, 2013, Bastille Day, I think it is. Some sort of symbol of liberation. We are beginning Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 118. We're on page 441. It has been so far an intricate and interesting study. And we've been largely dealing with the three great constellations, so powerful at this time, Leo, Pisces, and Capricorn, and their extensions as their energy descends through zodiacal, planetary, and planetary focuses, foci, and to our planet and to the tiny little microcosm, the man. So those have been constellational triangles. They are all of them, the three of them, chakric centers within the one about whom naught may be said. This great being that I've been calling not just a cosmic logos, but a super constellational logos, and which is seen as the unknown on page 293 of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Within the sphere of influence of this being, we live and move and have our being, and DK has told us something of the nature of this being, even though in a deeper sense we can't really say anything, we can't really know anything. But at least there has been an outline of the zodiacal constellations found within the heart and the head center of the one about whom naught may be said, and the discussion of certain other great constellations in a zodiac of 10, which are part of this great being. And they are all cosmic logoi. And a description of our sun, our solar logos, within, as a heart center within one of those cosmic logoi. And the cosmic logos seems to me perhaps to be a solar plexus center, and it may include the star Sirius, page 50 of Esoteric Astrology, gives us some hints about the seven solar systems of which ours is one. These are extensive considerations. The great energy has come from distant sources, and we are coming into rapport via Devic streams with that great energy, although, of course, not directly, but in a transformed and reduced manner. It's also we can induce a greater sense of livingness in our lives and share that livingness so that we can become alive to the greater possibilities, to the greater things, which are ever around us, ever ready to be revealed, ever revealing themselves, could we but see. And this, of course, depends upon our own energy system and our own stage of evolution. We're talking about very big things, but the point is that they do have an extension, an application here below. And it is in their impact that we find the main value of this type of study. These things really do impact us. DK has traced the lines, the sixfold lines, by which the Great Bear, the Sirius, the Sun Sirius, or the system of Sirius, and the Pleiades descend and actually make an impact upon our centers. So we're talking about real living experiences. And we have to transform all of our theory about these great sources into the realization that these impacts do exist and that we can and should avail ourselves of these energies. We've come to the point here where we're talking about triangles of force, which are planets. Generally, the word energy has been used in connection with the cosmic lives, which are constellations, although I would say there's a lot of ambiguity about how these terms are used. We have also been speaking about these three triangles, leaving out the great emanating sources of Great Bear Sirius and Pleiades, and these consist of one zodiacal factor, a constellation, one planet, which is not really a ruler of the zodiacal source, and one of the three great centers on our planet, Shambhala hierarchy, or humanity. And we've spent quite a bit of time discussing these in particular. We're simply following Master DK's text. He has his own method of writing. He's presenting these subjects for careful consideration, and he always advises us to read carefully, more carefully actually than we do read often. So by this kind of close attention, paragraph by paragraph, line by line, phrase by phrase, word by word, we are perhaps allowing ourselves the opportunity for what he is really saying to sink in a deeper way than it has before. Triangles of force, planets. I've given some definitions of energy and force. It all has to do with the direction of an application of energy to form. It seems that a force must have a target and be applied to form, whereas energy can simply exist in a freer state, waiting to be applied to various force units. Although, as I say, the strict use of differentiation between these two words, energy and force, is not always observed. At the same time, says Master DK, it will be obvious to you that in relation to these simple triangles, certain interlocking triangles also emerge. Interlocking, as for instance, the zodiacal triangle of Leo, Pisces, Capricorn, and the allied planetary triangle of Saturn, Mercury, Uranus, Mercury. Remember, there are horizontal triangles we've been discussing, and they involve members which all express more or less at the same level of evolution, lords of constellations, for instance, or lords of planets. And then there are isosceles triangles. I mean, I think these horizontal triangles are equilateral, in my view. Isosceles triangles in which there's one dominating member and two others that are more or less equivalent but lesser than the dominating member. Well, such a triangle might be, let us say, Gemini, Mercury and Venus. Mercury and Venus are more on the same level, but Gemini is the lord of a constellation. Then there are scalene triangles. They have three sides which are unequal. One largest, one middling, and one smallest. And such a triangle as we've been discussing are, in that sense, scalene triangles. When we look at Leo, lord of a constellation, Saturn, the lord of a planetary logos, and then one of the centers in our planet, which would be Shambhala. So it descends from greater to lesser. This is one way of organizing our thoughts about triangles. So here are what DK calls some interlocking triangles. Leo, Pisces, Capricorn, and Saturn, Uranus, Mercury. These two triangles pour their six streams of force into our three major, our three planetary centers at this time. There are other planetary centers, of course, but we are dealing largely here with head, heart, and throat, vitalizing and stimulating the planetary triangle of Shambhala hierarchy and humanity. So The lords of the planets are also stimulating Shambhala, as well as the zodiacal lords, and in a more indirect and distant sense, the lords of the three great constellations are stimulating our planetary centers. I mean, you know, I'm not saying there's not one God. There is one God. This is not, this is what I call an enlightened polytheism, because it sees all the many gods as extensions of the one God, sharing his essence, or sharing its essence, but diverse in the scope of their consciousness and manifestation. Yet all are what this one God is, essentially. Behind these three stand the cosmic triangle, emanating three streams of energy which pour into and through the three lesser triangles, thus potently affecting every kingdom in nature. And remember, kingdoms are system-wide, aren't they? They are not just pertaining to our planet. There are kingdoms noticeable on our planet, but these kingdoms exist throughout the solar system, and maybe, in a way, throughout the cosmos. And the cosmic triangle is the Great Bear, Sirius, and Pleiades. This is not to say that the zodiacal lords are not cosmic. They are, and even the solar logos is considered a cosmic being, and in certain contexts, the planetary logos is as well. But these are truly cosmic beings, even beyond the stature, apparently, of our planet, of our zodiacal lords. The measurement of the comparison of the power between the lords of the three great constellations and the zodiacal lords is a tricky subject. And as I've said, we could learn something about it by studying our own etheric body and see what is the status of any one of the petals in the major 12-petaled heart within the head center. How strong, how influential is any one of those petals, because each one of the zodiacal lords and his and the constellation to which he expresses is a petal in the heart and the head center of the one about whom naught may be said. So this paragraph, says DK, is simply summarizing the preceding pages and indicates the relation between four triangles of energy, and they are the three great cosmic constellations, the three zodiacal constellations, the three planetary expressions of planetary logoi, and the three major centers on our planet, Shambhala hierarchy, and humanity. There are one or two subsidiary points which are of interest to the esoteric astrologer, and these might briefly, we might briefly list in connection with these effective triangles, using the word effective to imply conditioning and potent in results. After all, DK is trying to be as practical as he can be and to notify us of sources which really do make a difference here in how we live our life. There are probably so many sources which are effective elsewhere and interesting in their own right, but are not of immediate moment to our progress as humanity. In this present world cycle, all results are of unusual significance and also unusually emphasized in human consciousness. You know, we are living, what does he say, living in this time of great disturbance and possibility. And he gave us the reasons earlier in terms of the completion of cycles and changes of the Earth axis and the transition of the ages and the influence of the moon. I've listed them all that he has given. And also the reversing of the wheel by humanity itself. At least the first reversal of the wheel. It's never complete at that first time. The wheel is not reversed. The wheel is turning in two directions at the same time. So humanity, with its fourth ray, is caught in two directions and struggling with itself, trying to go forward and yet pulled backward at the same time. That is the fourth ray fate, until harmony is achieved. All right. He's saying a bit more here, that Saturn, through which the energy of energy flows from Leo, and we wouldn't know this, would we? I mean, normally we think, okay, here is the sun, maybe veiling Jupiter in some sense. Here is the, that's exoteric. Here is the sun veiling Neptune. Here is the sun veiling Uranus. It's the sun and these other three planets. It's not Saturn. And yet, these are great beings in our local cosmosphere, and they have relationships which are not just those of the rulers to the constellational lords. So energy definitely does flow from Leo via Shambhala to humanity. And it says Saturn governs two decanates in Capricorn. Well, let's try to be specific. It rules twice. But the Deccan rulers, as I recall, just been through this. Let's pause for a minute and get them. So here we are on this table. The Deccan rulers are actually Saturn, Venus, Mercury, with Sun, Vulcan, in a sense, veiled. So Saturn, technically speaking, unless the Tibetan is using the word decanate as phases of life which a planet may rule, because Saturn does rule in Capricorn the first phase of life, forcing the soul to remain in durance vile. I guess that's the word, old words, durance vile, and enduring vile circumstances in the lower worlds. But then later offers the way of escape into the higher worlds, ruling the first part of the Antikorana, which basically is connecting the personality through the mental unit to the soul itself on its own plane. So Saturn rules one decanate technically, but if we look at decanates in the way that Master DK seems to be looking at them here, it governs two phases of development in Capricorn. Hence its extreme potency today in the triangle of humanity. Well, the triangle of humanity, in a way, is the Pleiades, Mercury, Capricorn, and Mercury. But then you see, Saturn is a ruler of Capricorn, because Saturn is a ruler of Capricorn twice. So it governs two spans in the overall range of Capricornian development. And this is important, you know, about Saturn. Saturn breaks up existing conditions by the force of its energy impact. Normally, in conventional astrology, that is a task given to Uranus. But Saturn does put on the pressure, and that which is not well built will collapse, thus enabling the influence of Mercury to be expressed more fully. So this triangle, we want to say that in the triangle of humanity, Saturn is active, though not mentioned. I don't want to say in the triangle, I want to say in relation to the triangle of humanity. Saturn is active, though not mentioned, and hence other planets would be active, or in relation to, the other triangles. For instance, in the triangle of Shambhala, we have a Leo rulership, so the Sun would be active, and its veiled planets, Uranus and Neptune. And in the triangle that involves the second aspect and is hierarchically related, then Jupiter and Pluto would be active, because they rule Pisces, even though Uranus is the planet through which transmission is occurring. So, you know, what is the point here? There are so many of these relationships. Every planetary lord in our solar system has a relationship with every other. Every zodiacal lord with every other. And it's not only the rulerships which make a planet related to a particular constellation lord. But there are planetary lords that are related to other constellations which they do not technically rule. And only esoteric astrology will reveal this. The limited human mind has made some arbitrary relationships here. He said, you know, the elemental triplicities, four of them, are in a sense arbitrary. There's a lot more subtlety in the zodiacal interplay than simply fire, earth, air, and water signs would indicate, or the assignment of the signs to those four elemental triplicities. Saturn breaks up existing conditions by the force of its energy impact, thus enabling the influence of Mercury to be more fully expressed. This is in decanate fashion. This is often done. DK discusses Aquarius and how the work of Saturn prepares the way for Mercury and the Mercury decanate to do its work, and I suppose the illuminating work of Mercury prepares the way for Venus in the final decanate of Aquarius. So in this particular case, Saturn, as the planetary lord connected with the Shambolic Triangle, is preparing the way for the illumination of Mercury to be more fully expressed. It's not a decanate relationship here between Saturn and Mercury, at least not in this sign. The vision of Mercury can then be intuitively perceived, and that's Mercury, when obstructions have been removed. So what he's saying is very important, that Saturn, in some sense, appearing as the obstructor, if there's such a word, as the obstructor, is actually a planet given to the clearing of obstructions. I mean, so many things we have to deal with, we're forced to deal with karmically, seem like obstructions to us, but when dealt with, they open the door to a greater flow of energy. So we are presented with circumstances, Saturn again, and Master Moria says obstacles are possibilities. When we deal with these circumstances in the best possible way, those presented to us, and thus fulfill Saturn in a karmic sense, then doors open, and the higher functions of Saturn can be revealed, and other planets can send their energies into a system which was blocking their entry because the obstructions were not clear. So Saturn, the planet of discipleship, let's just say we must fulfill our Saturn. And sometimes, you know, we want to run away from that, and we don't want to be in the place where we find ourselves and fulfill the duties in the place where we find ourselves. Master Moria talking about how we either won't open the door when the messenger is knocking at the door, or we run off into the woods when already the messenger has come for us. So we act like the hare, the constellation of Lepus the hare related to Gemini. We run away from the hound of heaven, the lesser dog and the greater dog, Procyon and Sirius. We run away, and we don't allow ourselves to be caught by a higher influence, which is trying to guide our lives in spiritual ways. Leo is one of the birth signs of the zodiac, interesting, ruling the first initiation where the first spiritual birth takes place. And so is Capricorn, one of the birth signs. You know, we celebrate the birth of the Christ consciousness in Capricorn at Christmas, at the solstice, Capricorn solstice. But here it connotes the birth of self-consciousness, as you know, and in a way, Leo is active, as we realize, at individualization, where there was the birth into the human kingdom of the otherwise unself-conscious consciousness that was that of the animal. So the beginning of self-awareness was born in Leo. Capricorn is also a birth sign. Okay, I don't know if I'm doing this from memory or whether it occurs to me, or whether it occurs to me because it is from memory. But anyway, I didn't even see this, that Capricorn is a birth sign, but so it is. Because it is also an aspect of one of the arms of the cardinal cross, the cross which initiates or brings into being. And let's see, every entry into a new sphere is a birth. So it seems that the various arms of the cardinal cross are involved in birth. I mean, Aries is always the new thing. And the emergence into a new area through one's own initiative, it connects with the will to initiate and the first ray. That's a birth. And Capricorn is bringing a birth into the fifth kingdom. And we could ask, Cancer is bringing about the birth of the soul into incarnation. What does Libra birth if the cardinal cross initiates and brings into being? Does it birth the truly social person who realizes that he is not alone? Does it birth the sense of group consciousness? Because, wherever there are two or more, wherever two or more are gathered in my name, there am I. So, in a way, under Venus, Libra is the birthing of group consciousness with the upper hemisphere of the zodiacal wheel within that upper hemisphere. All right, well, anyway, this has a peculiar relation to humanity. It is the birth of the two types of consciousness, self-consciousness and Christ consciousness. Though, interestingly enough, when Christ consciousness is being birthed at the first initiation, Leo is often considered to be the sign that rules that first initiation. So the lion and the unicorn, they are closely related. They're not in the same triplicity, they're not in the same quadruplicity, and yet esoteric astrology reveals they are related. So what do we know? That the relationships between these great zodiacal lords is far more intricate than we would have just imagined with our own conventional, somewhat geometrizing thought. So we should listen very carefully to one who knows these deeper relations, and then perhaps our intuition will awaken and we can begin to see the interconnections. It is the birth of the two types of consciousness, self-consciousness and Christ consciousness, which are brought to the attention of humanity by the fact of this Leo force. It's involved really in both, pouring through Saturn to humanity and thus bringing Shambhala and humanity into closer relationship via Capricorn active through Mercury. This is one of those synthetic paragraphs. We realize that the Capricorn triangle there is involved with humanity, but Saturn is working in the Shambhalic triangle and as a related ruler in the triangle of humanity. So the illumination of the Christ consciousness will be brought about, and Leo gives us as well the will to illumine, we are told. Shambhala or the monad is very active at the first initiation, though only on the level of the soul, so we don't really detect it. So at this birth of the Christ consciousness, Shambhala is really present, or the monad is really present. In a way, we can say monad and Shambhala are equivalent in certain senses. Though naturally, there's much more to Shambhala than what we call the monad. So this is a connection here between Leo and Capricorn. So the self-consciousness and the Christ consciousness are brought to the attention of humanity by the fact of the Leo force, but I might also say through the Capricornian force, which rules five initiations beginning with the first. At least that's one way to look at it. Maybe five initiations beginning with the third is yet another way to look at it, which are brought to the attention of humanity by the fact of this Leo force pouring through Saturn to humanity and, you know, coming into the human triangle, and thus bringing Shambhala, that is the Leo line, and humanity, the Capricorn line, into closer relation. Yes, via Capricorn, active through Mercury, which is ruling the human kingdom as a whole through its number four. So here is a statement given in a way in pure reason. All of these relationships should appear to the eye suddenly and as a pattern. And DK under Mercury is helping us connect these factors. We can always connect via similarity. In this particular case, Saturn is the factor of similarity relating the Shambhalic triangle with the human triangle, in which it rules the foremost sign in the human triangle. And we have a connection in that both Leo and Capricorn are active at the first initiation. Well, they may be active together at other initiations as well. The third and even the fifth, there are different reasons for saying so. But now we're dealing with the birth of Christ consciousness. The birth of self-consciousness occurs at individualization. That's a long time ago on our planet, some 21 million years ago, and earlier for those who are from the moon chain or from the previous solar system. So these signs, Leo and Capricorn, are closely interrelated, and as they are, so are the two triangles, one the triangle of Shambhala, and the other the triangle of humanity, and perhaps in these Shambhala impacts, these two triangles facilitate the reception of the Shambhala force by humanity. We read earlier how this emerging of the magnetic hierarchical triangle of Pisces-Uranus hierarchy with that of humanity. Now we're reading about the merging of the Shambhalic triangle with the triangle of humanity, and I suppose because it's so important, hierarchy's approach to Shambhala, we would be reading about the merging of the Shambhalic triangle with the hierarchical triangle. There are some ways via Uranus that this can be done, and there's a Neptune connection as well. Uranus is the veiled hierarchical ruler of Leo, and it is active in the descent of the Piscean force, so there's a connection there. Neptune is the veiled esoteric ruler of Leo, and Neptune is as well a special ruler of Pisces, so there's a connection there. And in a way, Saturn and Uranus make a pair, ruling respectively the denser part of materiality, which is Saturn, and the more etheric part of materiality, which is Uranus. So there are a number of connections between the Shambhalic triangle and the hierarchical triangle, which facilitate their interplay. And I suppose we'd have to look at the connections between the Great Bear, which is behind the whole Shambhalic triangle, and Sirius. And if we're dealing in some way with the Sirian system, then there are seven solar logoi whom I suspect are related to the seven rishis of the Great Bear. That the rishis of the Great Bear are not only related to the planets in our solar system, they probably have many relations of which we know nothing, but to the seven solar systems of which ours is one and of which Sirius may be a part. I have to say that with reservation, but it is so close to our solar system that one would think it simply must have a part, it's so influential, that the seven rishis of the Great Bear would be related to the seven major stars in the seven solar systems of which ours is one. There are always other and lesser stars, you know, just the way there are other and lesser planets in our solar system, but only seven of them are really sacred. This is all part of understanding what hierarchical status is as it applies to these great beings. Perhaps we can understand something more about human unfoldment and status, spiritually considered, when we can understand these things in relation to the greater beings. We know there are differentiations in development among the planets and, presumably, though not stated, among the zodiacal constellations and also among the major chakra constellations of the one about whom naught may be said. Everything has its own status in the eyes or the eye of the one universal logos, which reveals the true proportion between things. That really is the all-seeing eye, that universal logoic eye that we can presume sees all within the confines of this universe, which had a beginning and will have an end. Anything that has a beginning and an end is finite. Well, this is the argument for the finite or infinite universe. You know, you can't have an infinite universe which is periodical, because then it is bounded. But anyway, that's another matter. At this point, I would like to pause for a moment and interpolate a word in answer to a perfectly normal question, which is liable to arise in the minds of thinking students and aspirants everywhere. And maybe it has arisen for us. Of what use is all this abstruse and abstract information to a world in agony and a world distressed? Because at the time that this was written, you know, part of it in the lead-up to World War II, and maybe some of it actually during World War II, I think my brother Keith knows more exactly when these parts were written, but there are hints in what is said, sometimes that the war has not yet occurred and sometimes that it has. Of what use is all this abstruse and abstract information to a world in agony and a world distressed? The major usefulness of this imparted information, which will condition the astrology of the future, lies far ahead, in a period after the war, when again the field of world service opens and men have time for thought and due reflection. Sometimes I think some of us are very blessed that now we do have such time. It doesn't mean that we don't have difficult situations occurring and maybe another war impending. Let us hope not. But far in the future. And if it is true that even after the Armageddon, which is predicted, there will be a period of peace, and Satan will be bound for 1,000 years, as it is symbolically said, there will be due time for thought and reflection. World service is going on now perhaps in greater volume than ever before, but it is restricted to the field of releasing from slavery and the alleviation of pain and suffering, and therefore to the more strictly physical forms of help, which of course are absolutely necessary, especially when the cry is going out because the agony is so severe. The service to which I here refer is that educational process which will produce the coming civilization and its attendant culture. So there is educational service, and it is that in which we here are involved and in which the various esoteric schools in the world are involved, and in which the Moria Federation is involved with the University of the Seven Rays. There are many, many groups which are now undertaking this esoteric educational work, and even if it's not esoteric, there is an educational process on a more normal level which is also preparing for the coming civilization and the culture of values which attends the existence of any civilization. This will be based on all the cultural processes of the past and of the present but will discard all that has produced the disasters today as far as may be possible. And those are certain forms of thought which are separative, which incline towards presumed superiority, which dehumanize other human beings and make them seem less than or non-essential. All of these cleavages based on an illusory understanding of what man really is must be discarded. Sometimes, you wonder how thoughts can have such effect for good or for ill. But it is thoughts and their attendant emotions which are the cause of that violence between human beings we call war. We have to correct these thoughts, and that can be corrected by the spreading of the ageless wisdom, the great thoughts of the ages, which give the true perspective of truth as seen by our planetary and solar logos and by still greater beings. Truth is very limited when seen by a limited consciousness. What a limited consciousness imagines to be the truth is a distortion or a great limitation upon what a greater consciousness will see. So we have to give credit to the possible existence of these greater units of consciousness. It all adds up, of course. There's such a coherent presentation of the ageless wisdom, and it does have practical results. It's not just pie in the sky kind of theorization. It's something that has immediate application to life. So this means a gradual future usefulness for the knowledge of the underlying potencies. And we can comfort ourselves a little bit that way. We're trying to learn about these things. And they may not yet have a great applicability. As a matter of fact, even astrology as presently practiced and taught may not accept these types of ideas that are expressed in esoteric astrology. So even those who should be the first to recognize the value may not yet recognize it, though that is improving. This means a gradual future usefulness for the knowledge of the underlying potencies. And we together are working on promoting that future usefulness, which may exist now because we are actually in the future when compared with the time that DK was writing this book. For they can indicate the lines of least resistance to the emerging good and the developing crises which inevitably lie ahead in the period of reconstruction. So let's just say that right understanding of these energies promotes the necessary skill in action. But one potent good can emerge even at this time from the study of these matters, provided the student of esotericism rests not content with study, using it as an escape from the disastrous present, but parallels his understanding of the causes and conditions by strenuous effort to be of aid in a practical and definitely physical sense. So we are not being left off the hook in any sense. This was written, as I say, in the lead up to the war, and perhaps some of it during the war. And he says that those who think that their entire service consists of meditation are evading responsibility. Perhaps there are some beings of a very high caliber who have long ago fulfilled many physical responsibilities, who have such potency in meditation that indeed their major service is meditation. Master Moria speaks of the yogi in the cave who is present in all sorts of circumstances in the world, even though his presence is not felt or sensed. Anyway, we cannot avoid working with hands and feet, and the Christ has said that the New Age will be built by human hands and human feet. There is that marvelous painting by Nicholas Roerich. I don't know exactly what it's called, but I think it's something like Christ in the Desert. I may be mistaken there, but it does show this man with a rather blondish tint to his hair, with a dark figure next to him who I think goes by the name Russell M, and who is an earlier appearance of Master Moria, in my opinion. So he could write about it because he was there. This is the dominant emerging fact to which all that I have said bears testimony. World conditions today, precipitated as they are by human greed and ignorance, with the Axis powers being the major precipitators there, the Taurian rulership of the Nazi powers under Hitler, very greedy, and the ignorance caused by glamour of superiority, precipitated as they are by human greed and ignorance, are nevertheless basically conditioned by the will to good, which is the primary quality of the energies and forces coming forth from the great lives in which all that exists live and move and have their being. So, will to good, a very high type of will coming forth from the great lives. The law of the universe, yeah, because sometimes we might think, you know, that the will to good is something microcosmic, something planetary. No, the primary energies and forces coming forth from the great lives we have been discussing carries with it the will to good as seen by much greater beings than we have even within our, upon our planet or within our solar system. The law of the universe, and what is law but the working out of the purposes of these all-embracing lives, of their impulses, and of their plans. This is a good definition of law, working out of the purposes of the great lives, their impulses, and their plans. And we don't know yet what he means by universe. Sometimes it's a smaller thing, you know, sometimes in these astrophysical days when we say the word universe, we mean the grand entirety. Maybe he, sometimes he, when he uses the word cosmos, he means more of that, but we pay attention here. The law of the universe is to all eternity the good of the whole. Well, I guess we can't consider then the universe the grand entirety, and naught can arrest this happening. The good of the whole, which is the good of every part within the whole, every apparent part within the whole. For who can arrest these energies which play upon and through our planet? No little life, no microcosmic life can do that. And when I say this, I would at the same time point out that the attitude of many students, inevitably participants in world events, is such is the law and such is the karma of people and nations and such is the predetermined destiny. That attitude is far from right. It avoids responsibility, and it avoids the urge under the will to good to improve conditions. There's a hands-off attitude. This is what they have to suffer, and one does not realize oneself as a true participant in the entire mix, whose obligation it is to continue to express the will to good and thus ameliorate present apparently karmic conditions. But it does relieve from responsibility, of course, and therefore brings relief to the personality. They believe sometimes sincerely that all that should be done is simply to wait for results to appear and for karma and destiny to fulfill themselves. Thus, they are passive and are not fulfilling responsibility. They believe sometimes sincerely that all that should be done is simply to wait for results to appear and for karma and destiny to fulfill itself. But of course, there's only one identity in this entire cosmos. And that identity, when it awakens sufficiently, has the responsibility of being an expression of the will to good, as much as it can understand what that is. Then and not till then, all will be well. But they forget that karma fulfills itself in relation to the form nature upon which it expends its energy, and that where there is a static condition and a quiescent attitude, the process moves but slowly. So there can be a hastening of the karmic fulfillment. Master Mori advises, when dealing with karma, to ride ahead with full speed, because he says the arrows of karma have a more difficult time reaching the one in motion. So passivity, quiescence, the refusal to insert one's will into the process as a corrective, delays the clearing which the karmic rebalancing is intended to provide. The process moves but slowly. The life then within the form fails to experience the needed forceful awakening. So our dynamic will must be applied to karmic situations. And a passive attitude is delaying and not desirable. Inevitably then there lies ahead a repetition of the process until the time comes when activity and response is invoked. In other words, our corrective to the undesirable conditions is demanded. When we see a karmically difficult situation, it is meant to evoke something from us. A karmically difficult situation is meant to evoke from us some action or response or intervention. And if it does not, we are expressing a subtle attitude of separateness. This then leads to resistance to the apparent karmic necessity. Yes, apparent karmic necessity, because if we could intervene and ameliorate, that too might be considered part of the karma. And this brings about liberation. So response is needed. Right response. Right response to karmic difficulty in our lives or in the lives of others is demanded. Needed. Only through resistance to evil, and in this world period and in this Kali Yuga, as the Eastern teachers call it, it is an essential basic attitude, can karma be brought to an end? Well, now look. Look at this. The old saying is, resist not evil. And DK tells us definitely to resist evil. This is somehow very important. And Master Moria pretty well says the same thing. There is awakened in the knowing one a repulsion against the presence of evil and an attempt to repel that evil. Of course, it depends on what level one works. That resistance need not be through any evil evocation, like hatred. Evil ceaseth, the idea is that evil ceaseth not through the application of evil. And hatred, that's it, hatred ceaseth not through hatred. But one can resist according to occult means, which is strengthening the will to good in all the players within a karmically evil situation. Resistance to evil, but wisely undertaken, is necessitated in this period of the Kali Yuga. Now, what is a Kali Yuga? There are different types of measurements, and some are vast ages, some like 432,000 years, and others are smaller parts of even a Platonic cycle of 25,000 years. So we have major and minor, I think, Kali or dark sections of different cyclic spans. The law of matter still governs in the three worlds of human experience, and fire by friction, remember that's the fire of purification, we talked about that, purification, qualification, and initiation. Fire of purification must burn up that which veils the steadily increasing brilliance of solar fire. So purification leads to the emergence of solar fire. It is the recognition of solar fire as it shows itself in transcendental idealism, not just emotional idealism towards the value of some form. Transcendental idealism and radiance by the unintelligent idealist and his simultaneous refusal to cooperate in this period of comic necessity that is prolonging the difficult and cruel situation. Okay, well, I think we have to, I guess how I would put this is we have to have a practical transcendental idealism. Is there such a possibility? What would DK say of the transcendentalists who expressed themselves in the 1840s and so forth of our of the 19th century in America? Transcendental idealism, I want to say, applied practically. Well, must burn up the veils that steadily increasing brilliance of solar fire. Okay, the law of matter still governs in the three worlds of human experience, and fire by friction must burn up that which veils the steadily increasing brilliance of solar fire. But of course, transcendental idealism in the sense applied here will prevent the fire by friction from doing its job, and the excessive love of form and of that which veils the true radiance and brilliance of solar fire will act as an obstacle. It is the recognition of solar fire as it shows itself in a transcendental idealism and radiance by the unintelligent idealist and his simultaneous refusal to cooperate in this period of comic necessity that is prolonging the difficult and cruel situation and leading him inevitably to sink deeply into glamour. So we need a practical application of solar fire and not a transcendentally impractical approach or reception of solar fire. The energy itself is needed, but of course it can be used in the wrong way. Well, we're getting to that point. Okay. The simplification of the world's problems in terms of matter comes through a recognition of the essential dualism underlying events. Matter, which is in a way a type of perception, will ever be with us. The entire universe is matter from a highly metaphysical point of view. The only thing that is truly immaterial is absoluteness. And as the universe appears, it is the one divine object. It is matter. It is any limitation upon the absolute is matter. I want to say that and then ponder the implications later. So, any limitation upon absolute, including the universe, is matter. Sounds like a crazy idea, but okay, I think there's something to it. I commend this thought to all students, that the simplification of the world's problem in terms of matter comes through a recognition of the essential dualism, spirit-matter, underlying events. I commend this thought to all students, suggesting that they base optimism on the long-range vision, not be bewildered by the terror of the moment, which seems like it may last forever, but cannot. When it's said that this too shall pass, perhaps there is a that, metaphysical that, which shall not pass. Anyway, optimism is to be based on the long-range vision endorsed by the heavens in their attempt to contact all the lesser lives and corroborated by the activity of the stars. Beautiful poetic language, and thus feel sure of the ending of this immediate and tragic situation. Tragic because it could have been avoided when a good individual has some flaw which undoes the expression of his goodness and leads him into situations which, if he had expressed but good, he would never enter. When that happens, that's the tragedy. Something about the goat play. The play of the goat. I think the term goat is involved in the meaning of the word tragedy, and thereby we see the pull between the highest and the lowest, the initiatory possibilities of the good and the denser possibilities of that which is elemental and related to the lower physical worlds. So, we are also in difficult situations, but we know that this too shall pass. We have the recrudescence of the great sixth ray preparing to pass out entirely within another century, and perhaps there's some kind of ingathering of those upon the sixth ray which make them act in what looks like such an unintelligent way, but which may be necessary if they are to experience the necessary required sacrifices and are to learn how to sacrifice the form for something higher. However blind and apparently unintelligent their mode of operation may be at the present time. Everything depends on the scope of consciousness. And there are so many in the world that are not interested in the ageless wisdom and are not blessed by being able to read with some degree of understanding the ageless wisdom to give them a broad, broad view of life so they do not become captivated by lesser objectives and overemphases which are not corresponding to that which the eye of truth reveals, especially the greater eyes of truth. Well, time will tell. And humanity, 100 years ago, was passing through a very serious trial. It was the First World War, the beginning of the war which lasted some 31 years in two phases. Time will tell. So anyway, this will be the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 118A, and we are on some page or another, yeah, page 444, and beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 118B, page 444.